10 years later, it's clear these promises certainly have not come true. Still, of course, a lot of interesting and relevant science has come out of this big project, but with the specific criticism I raised back then, I would uphold that this notion of just putting together what we know, simulating it, and then solving brain disorders, I think that's wrong. You could argue that one aspect of it is that they have very clearly defined, measurable, quantifiable goals. But I think in neuroscience we are lacking the methodological convergence. We do not know which approach is best or even proven to succeed in understanding the brain. We don't have a community consensus. And in 2019 we published the first cortical connectome, this time already about 20 to 40 times more efficient than our retinal connectome because of better AI that we had been developing and using by that time. And now we are really moving to the phase where we think we can largely replace the human annotator by AI. And that's really a very recent development, and I think will now move our field forward much faster. We didn't have to use flapping wings to fly. So we don't have to build birds to fly. I wouldn't say conceptually we have to build brains to build human level intelligence. I think the mechanisms behind it, and then the application possibilities of AI, that's really important. Yes, my name is Moritz Helmstetter. I'm a director at the Max Planck Institute for Brain Research in Frankfurt, Germany. And my research is on the networks of the brain, the neuronal networks that we all have in our skulls. In particular, we aim at mapping these networks using electron microscopy and other methods. This is a research field that we call connectomics. So I lead the Department of Connectomics at the Max Planck Institute for Brain Research. If we think about our brains, then obviously the sheer number of nerve cells is stunning, 86 billion as far as we know. The sheer number of synapses is stunning. But what is really unique about our brains is the connectivity between the nerve cells, the interaction between the neurons. And this is carried out via synapses and creates a synaptic network of a degree of a complexity that we don't find in essentially any other system. It became clear to me that if we really want to make progress in understanding brain function, one key missing piece of information is the structure and the shape and the architecture of these neuronal networks in our brains. So I set out to find methods and learn and develop methods that would allow us to map these networks so that we can, as I hope, make progress on understanding brain function. When the original Human Brain Project was proposed and conceived, it had a very strong emphasis on taking all the data that's available at the time and creating a model out of it. Now, that alone is no problem with it, but then there were very, very strong claims being made about this model then essentially solving autism and other brain disorders. And that claim was something that I and many other colleagues were very skeptical about. And more than skeptical, we were very worried about this claim, because I think we have to be very responsible to communicating to the public as scientists. And if we make promises that are really very clearly not going to fulfill themselves, that are clearly wrong, then that's really not okay. We have to communicate openly and, yes, of course, hopefully. I mean, as I also did right now, I'm telling you that maybe connectomics is going to help us a lot. But we have to put the caveat to it. We have to tell about the uncertainty, and we should not make claims that are most certainly not true. And this, I think, is also now 10 years later. It's clear these promises certainly have not come true. Still, of course, a lot of interesting and relevant science has come out of this big project. But the specific criticism I raised back then, I would uphold that this notion of just putting together what we know, simulating it, and then solving brain disorders. I think that's wrong. So I think if you create a big scientific project like the Human Brain Project with a billion or something like that on that scale of euros as funding, then the question is not whether there will be some cool science coming out of it. That's a given. I mean, if you have so much money, there should be something very interesting and relevant coming out of it. And I think that's also clear that there has been a lot of relevant and super interesting research being produced by collaborators of the Human Brain Project. The benchmark, I think, is you have to compare it to what would have happened if I had taken this 1 billion euros, split it into 1,000 1 million euro projects, let's say, and spread it around Europe in all these different groups, or maybe 5 million and so on. Anyway, but you understand what I mean. And that is the benchmark, yeah? So what would that have produced compared to giving it to one consortium and letting them do their job? And I think that's much harder to judge, and that's a much higher benchmark. Because for that, it's not enough to have produced great science. For that, you need to show that what you've produced could not possibly have come out of these many small projects. And I think there are some aspects of the project, which I don't know in all the details, but that certainly would go in that direction. But the big claim from the beginning has not been fulfilled. That was this claim of, okay, I take the data that there is, I build a huge model, and I solve major problems in brain science. That clearly is not the case. And that is something that many colleagues predicted like that, and I also was very skeptical, and I think we have to admit that this certainly has not happened. So certainly physics is a great example of how big science can be very successful, and I have to say I sometimes envy physics for that. The big accelerators, they are great examples of very successful big science. Now, why are they so successful? You could argue that one aspect of it is that they have very clearly defined, measurable, quantifiable goals. They are big, they are expensive, they are certainly not something any small group could do, but they are very clear. Let's say, move the collision energy to whatever new value, and that will allow us to search for the Higgs boson or something like that. So this is something that that physics has, you know, spent decades developing a coherent model that allows them to really say, if I do X, I will be able to test Y, and here's the cost tag for it, and if someone pays for it, we will deliver. They're very good at it, and that's really the ideal world for big science. Now, that's much more difficult in neuroscience. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but I think in neuroscience we are lacking the methodological convergence. We do not know which approach is best or even proven to succeed in understanding the brain. There are many, many different approaches, from computational to molecular. Connectomics is one of them. Obviously, everyone thinks their approach is the best. Obviously, I think connectomics is very well worth it, but we don't have a community consensus. And that's different in physics for a large degree, at least. Now, I do think that biology has one great example of big science, which is the Human Genome Project. So that, of course, had exactly that, a very clearly defined goal that was very hard to reach, to map the first human genome. In the end, two consortia competed, and it really helped the whole thing to succeed. It's also a great example for a big project where the goal is clear and it can be achieved. However, the impact and the immediate consequences were totally wrongly predicted, or largely wrongly predicted. Everyone was hoping for, finally, the identification of a few key genes for so far not genetically linked diseases, also in the psychiatry field, of course. And that clearly, of course, did not happen, but it spurred the development of even faster sequencing and made possible GWAS, so genome-wide association screenings, and then thereby the possibility to identify these very polygenic backgrounds of very important diseases. So that's, I think, a beautiful example of human endeavor in science. Yeah, we have a methodological goal. We run like everything we can to reach it, even also competitively. We reach it, and then we're surprised by not finding what we expected. But that's why we do this, right? We otherwise, we wouldn't have to go for new continents, for new stars, for new parts of the universe, if we already knew what to find. So that's really also what drives me in connectomics. It's delivering data that no one has ever seen before. And then, of course, it could be that we are surprised both ways. So far, we've been mostly surprised by the precision and depth of the data, but there will also be cases where we don't find what we want to find or think we will find. Wonderful. That kills a hypothesis. Bye-bye. Let's go to the next hypothesis. So that's how it should be in science, and I think that's what can be done, but it's harder in neuroscience because we don't know yet what the exact milestones should be. I have to admit that, or I mean, luckily, I'm exactly working on what I would set as the goal for a project like this, not because I think others should be working on it, simply because I think that this is something that I really have a lot of faith in, but especially a lot of interest in, is mapping synaptic networks. So this is, I mean, I can argue why I think that they are so important. The synaptic level connectome is the place where our evolutionary learning, if you want to call it learning, so adaptation, of course, is the process, but selection, let's say evolutionary encoding of world knowledge. What kind of predators show up? Why is a striped beast dangerous? What about that eagle that comes close? And so on, these things evolutionarily possibly encoded. And then the individual knowledge, the individual learning during our lifetimes. The place where both of this comes together is the synaptic level connectome. It's not the cell type based connectome, because that's not where the individual knowledge is stored. It's also not the projectome, let's say, of a DTI image of the whole brain highway, so to say. That's not where individual knowledge is stored, but it's the synaptic level connectome. And so that's my argument why this has a lot of value and is not an arbitrary choice of description, but it's I think the right choice to move forward with understanding these brain networks. I profit from my physics education, so I'm not sure that physics profits, but I'm very much grateful to have received that very fundamental education in physics, because I always feel like it takes away the fear of complexity. So physics obviously has a century-old history of dealing with seemingly complex and very complicated, for sure, problems, but then developing quantitative methods to address problems. And if you get trained on that, you lose that fear. Obviously, it still can, there can be problems we can't, or I can't understand, of course. But you're trained. It's a bit part of the educational program in physics, is to make you fearless on these kinds of questions. And that certainly has worked. So at least you don't shy away from looking at something as complex as the neural networks. Again, I'm not claiming you can solve it just like that, but at least you're not afraid. So I think the most explicit sign of this level of interdisciplinarity is if I look at my junior colleagues in the lab, so all the students and postdocs, they come from very different backgrounds. So we have actually electrical engineers, not really. We have physicists, biologists, sometimes medical students. So a very broad range, also chemistry and so on, a very broad range of backgrounds. And this is just fun to work with, of course. I mean, we have all these different perspectives. Of course, some of us have to maybe learn a bit about neuroscience, actually don't maybe know a lot about the brain when coming in, but have perfect methods, skills to tackle data analysis problems. And then we all come together and teach each other. So that's really the clear sign of interdisciplinarity, and where it's also we have a common goal. So it's very clear why we are working together. And so this is just fun to work on these problems, because we can very clearly say how much progress we've made or not. And yeah, it's so far been very enjoyable. So when we take electron microscopic images of the brain, these are at very high resolution, of course, right? Because we want to follow these very thin cables that connect our neurons, these so-called axons. But if we do this over three dimensions, it means that we acquire very large data sets. Now, what is very large? 15 years ago, or almost 20 years ago, actually more than 20 years ago when we started off, terabytes were large, even still on the gigabyte scale. So we were acquiring terabyte data sets at the time, so very large data sets, and it became clear that we cannot analyze them by just looking at the images. When you have such dense packing of cables and synapses as we have in our brains, then the 3D structure is so complicated and so massive that tracing everything just manually would not work anymore because of time investment. So it became clear very early on that we would need some better automation. And in fact, this was around 2005, 2006, so actually really a long time ago now, that we started looking at machine learning methods for image analysis. And that was really not the standard at the time. At the time, you still had this so-called standard image processing, where you would design some filters and then apply them to the image, and then you have some outcome and you would be happy or not. But together with Winfried Denk, with whom I worked at the time, we started using machine learning methods. We first tried so-called k-nearest neighbor approaches. This is a very old school, if you want, but machine learning approach to a visual image problem, a visual data analysis problem. This was already quite unusual and led us already quite forward. And then we collaborated with Sebastian Sung, and he was using methods developed by Jan LeCun, namely the now famous convolutional neural networks. 2007, we applied them already to this kind of image data. This is really, I think, one of the earliest applications of this approach, and very successfully so. So this helped us moving forward. And then our first mammalian connectome that we published in 2013 was processed by usage of, at the time, modern AI methods. But we still had to use human brain power. So as much as we tried with machine learning and everything that was state of the art, we still needed massive human intervention, so to say. We hired, for that reason, hundreds of students, undergraduates, who helped us annotate our data. And the combination of their efficient annotation, we built the tools for that, with AI, at the time helped us deliver this first mammalian connectome of the retina. Actually, interestingly, the visual processing device of, in this case, a mouse, right? Which already tells you something about the interesting loop between AI and neuroscience, where on the one hand, we use AI methods to get a better understanding of the brain, but then also we are analyzing the very structures in our brain, in this case, at the back of the eye, that do this kind of analysis in the living organism. So it's a very interesting feedback cycle. And then since then, over the last now 10 years, we've used more and more AI to need less and less human time. So the, because you can't scale human time by a factor of 1,000, right? I mean, if we hire a few hundred students, hiring a few hundred thousand students would be very hard. So therefore, we really had to push forward and use AI and the improvements of AI to have less and less human work time consumed. And this worked very well. And in 2019, we published the first cortical connectome, this time already about 20 to 40 times more efficient than our retinal connectome because of better AI that we had been developing and using by that time. And now we are really moving to the phase where we think we can largely replace the human annotator by AI. And that's really a very recent development, and I think will now move our field forward much faster. So we have not looked directly into applying these kinds of transformer models. The experience has been in our case that we always succeeded best when finding a very well-focused solution to our very problem. So I think the large language models have a lot of potential, really, when it comes to language and other complex data worlds. Our data is not so complex in the sense that it has so many possible configurations. It's just very hard locally to disentangle and to understand where the continuation of these cables is. So that's a very focused problem. And actually, the way we have now addressed it is by considering it as a 3D flight problem. So we have 3D data, and we have built now an AI-based flight engine, so to say, that that learns to steer through the axons, along the axons. And that is it's now on BioArchive, the first version of this, we call it RoboEM, so a small robot essentially moving through EM data. And this is very successful in our hands right now. And it's an example of a very tailored solution to a very concrete problem, which still has advantages. It doesn't have to also speak any language. It's modeled after autonomous driving. That is a 2D problem where steering is a bit more restricted because you don't have Hopefully you don't have the third dimension. Yeah, you don't fly with your car. But in our case, yeah, it's more like a flight. It's more like a plane because it's 3D, right? The brain is 3D at that scale, and we really can navigate in all directions. So I think currently, the first thing I would look at is phenomenologically, so performance-wise, where are we at? And I think it's still absolutely clear that the biggest difference between modern AI and human intelligence is the efficiency of learning. If it's not so much the performance. We can nowadays create AI that is extremely good at certain things and more also at many things. So that I think is not the key difference anymore necessarily. But what is definitely a major difference is the efficiency of how you learn to do what you need to do. If you think about how a baby or then a young child learns to navigate the world, to understand what is a tree, what is a car, who are my parents, what are humans, what are cats, have you not? We use very few labels. We use a lot of data that's flowing in, but very innocently so in a way. And then we, have very few labels. And that is very efficient, and it's something that current AI is still struggling to do. Now, I'm not saying it's impossible, but this is still a major difference. The second major difference, again, phenomenologically, I think, is that we seem to be training a model of the world in our brains. We have some idea of how everything is functioning out there. Take gravity. We have some very immediate intuition about cars, again, not flying up in the air, planes not diving unless something bad happens, apples falling down, and so on. And this is just one example of physical laws being trained and learned and engraved into our brains in ways that we don't really understand. And today, AI is still, if it's learning such concepts, it's doing it by heavily, probably redundantly learning things that can and cannot happen. And most people believe that we don't yet have a way of learning this condensed law, so to say, the law behind the physical phenomena, let's say. Now, it's not necessarily necessary to learn these things as a law compared to just to the statistics of what's going on, but it seems to be much more efficient to have a good prediction of your world. So, and that's something that many people, many colleagues think is still a major difference between the human and artificial intelligence. If I may add one aspect, structurally, so how it's built, there are of course also still major differences. Most image processing in AI is forward networks, deep networks, forward connected only, right? So you have neither lateral nor backward connections. While this was the early understanding of the brain, retina, thalamus, cortex, so stepwise and then layers of cortex, next level, and so on, a forward processing engine. By no means is that all that's happening in our brains. Our brains are heavily recurrently connected. And so therefore, for instance, this is an example where image processing works very well in AI, but using methods that likely differ substantially from how the brain is doing it. Where it becomes more relevant is with recurrent networks, which are still very hard to manage in AI. It took a long time to find ways of learning them without them, this whole problem exploding, of learning to keep time scales, of learning to keep information over some memory time. That is something that our brains are doing very well. Now, what do I think could be an aspect that we could still learn from the human brain? I think we should look at inhibition. So that is something that is not explicitly treated in modern AI, and since we recently discovered that that is a specific enhancement of the human brain, even compared to the mouse, to have a lot of inhibitory synaptic networks. This is a topic that I would like to point to as something that we should understand better, and maybe there could be still something conceptually in there that will help us get even better AI. That's a very open, much open question in my view, whether AI will reconverge with human intelligence. It is true that AI in the early days was heavily inspired by neuroscience, and I am or have suggested that we will have multiple cycles of this mutual inspiration of neuroscience and artificial intelligence. But it could also be that AI will now use the methods we have already and accelerate it on the technological side. For instance, it could well be that the usage of quantum computing will create really a separate path of technological advancement that will not require more knowledge about the human brain. My personal gist still is that there is still something to be learned from the human brain about what I mentioned, this predictive learning, the encoding of models of the world, and also the way that memory is dealt with. I'm an observer and a listener to many of the voices coming from the AI world, and obviously very strong voices that think we have, as mankind, already discovered the key principles of AI. I share that view, that there are still major differences between what current AI can do and what we do as children, especially when we learn. And I would think that these arguments are more convincing to me. But I have to say, I always use the example, we didn't have to use flapping wings to fly. So we don't have to build birds to fly. I wouldn't say conceptually we have to build brains to build human level intelligence. For me, actually, it doesn't matter anymore, because it's clear that in isolated problems, we will always be outperformed, and increasingly also in the combination of isolated problems. I mean, obviously, we get outperformed in Go and in chess, and the combination of all of that, and now language models pretend to be smart and so on. This notion of the test, it has never been very attractive to me, because also I'm not a big fan of this whole consciousness concept. I'm not sure it really matters. It's in the end, you can define a performance measure, and then you can either successfully deliver it or not. I never found that super interesting, frankly, because I think the mechanisms behind it, and then the application possibilities of AI, that's really important. And then, of course, we have to make sure that we can control it still, yeah, and it's not taking over, but I'm not worried. I'm torn between a fundamental question, which is how knowledge about the world is encoded in the brain such that we can make sense of what's currently happening. Just a keyword, predictive coding. Are there circuits for predictive coding? If so, how do they look? What is the architecture in our cortex that allows us to so quickly analyze the world, compute probably something like the posterior over what's possible? What's the most likely hypothesis right now? Is that just a cloud, or maybe an animal in the sky? I mean, all these kind of crazy things we do all the time is, I think, predictive and strongly hypothesis-based. Understanding the architecture behind this kind of processing, that would be a fundamental question. But the question about possible circuit pathologies is more and more pressing, and something that we're also now heavily working on, especially because it would have such dramatic impact on our understanding of brain disease.